Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
We'll be going over the Torah portion for this particular week. It's called Tzav, which basically kicks up from Leviticus chapter 6, verse 8, and chugs through the end of chapter 8. But for time today, and because a lot of this we've already covered in the last portion of Vayikra, we're going to be just heading basically one little highlight with this. And also, we're going to be picking up, as you see here, talked about the a few passages from the section called Zakor, which means to remember. And that is actually usually included with the Shabbat before Purim. And so we're going to be picking it up this week because our celebration coincides with Shabbat. So we're going to pick it up at this point. And hopefully it'll set the stage for, why do we care about Purim? Why do we care, you know, 1,000-plus years later? Why do we care also as believers in Yeshua? What does this have to do with anything? So, quick way to say that is it's got a lot to do with things. And if you've ever wondered, because just like a year like we're having here, well, why is it when you have a leap year, say a leap year in the Hebrew calendar, is they don't just add a day like we do every 4 years. They add a month every, and it's a kind of a strange cycle, it may seem like, on how many years the intervening they add an extra month in. But the month is not added at the end. So in a year like this year, the 13 months, the 13th month is not the end. It is the second to the end. So we are actually, it's viewed as being in the 12th month, although really we're in the 13th month. We might say, well, that's kind of strange. Why, if you're going to be adding a 13th month in, why isn't it not at the end? And the important reason, as we'll see here today, there's a hugely important reason why that is. And that has to do with Passover, or as it's called in Hebrew, Pesach. It's that is why it is always kept 1 month away. And we will see a huge reason why in one of the passages that we'll look at here. So we're going to be going over a passage from Zakor, 1 Samuel chapter 15, and we'll also be hitting some highlights from Esther's chapters 3 through 6 today. One of the things that I always like to do, especially as you're getting into a section that's got a huge amount of details, is to get the big picture before you plow into anyone, even if we're going to be looking at a pretty high view today. So where are we? So here's a kind of a one outline, you could say, from the book of Leviticus, which shows us here when it's talking about the law of sacrifices, or as we saw from the beginning part when we went through the passage of Vayikra, which kicks it off, it is one, it's really the law of the korbanot. So you might have recognized korban from the Gospels when it talks about declare korban. Well, korban is what is, a good main term you'll meet in Vayikra Leviticus a lot. And that means, as we talked about in our last portion, it means strictly that which approaches or that which draws near. And one of the things we're saying from the high view of it, the book of Exodus ends with the tabernacle being consecrated and the glory of the Lord, the Shekhinah, the presence of the Lord moves in with the cloud and everybody has to get out. Everybody gets out. So Vayikra is about that which approaches. Everybody is now approaching. Everyone. And one of the things that we're looking at in the first section, we went through what the offerings are, the five real main types of offerings, the burnt offering, the grain offering, the peace offering, the sin offering, the guilt offering. And That should give you a hint that all offerings are not the same. And as you might notice from there, all offerings are not sin offerings. We might think, oh, well, every offering that's given is about sin. Thus, if you've got one offering for sin, then everything goes out the window. Well, that's only one of five. And actually, when you then take into what's recorded in the last letter of Hebrews, where it talks about you can approach and go through the veil by the blood of Mashiach with confidence, then it talks about guilt offering as well. So what are these all? What is the tabernacle itself? The tabernacle itself is what? The primary way into heaven, right? And everything in heaven is just a copy of it, right? No, it says it's the other way around. The tabernacle is a copy of the things in heaven. So that should tell you what? That the things that are in the tabernacle are always going to be a memorial of things happening in heaven. Always. So if you take them to be some sort of lucky charm, you pull the celestial jackpot handle and look for your winnings, well, nope. It's not going to work that way. You saw in Israel's history where they tried to treat the Ark of the Covenant like a lucky charm. And in modern parlance, they got pwned and it got taken. Because why? Eventually, you saw a terrible illustration, just like you see in the book of Job, where a foreign power is, in a sense, more righteous than Israel because they realize, hey, wow, we should treat this thing with respect. We should treat the message with respect. So, and that's a little bit of what we're looking at today with our celebration of Purim. So, with the recap here today, in this section that we're looking at, that really extends down through, you know, as you could see there through the end of chapter 7 and chapter 8 is really the consecration of the priesthood, we'll say, well, we've seen this before. And yes, you have. We saw this in the first five chapters of Leviticus. And you also saw it before in brief detail in the last chapters of Exodus. So this is, in this section today, we're looking at in detail for the priesthood. The priesthood, what the priesthood was supposed to focus on with these five offerings. The first one with the five offerings was about what the people bring, why the people are bringing it. And last time around, we focused in big time on that thing of the offering that covers unintentional sins and all of what's involved with that one. So today we're going to be focusing on just one in particular. And the one that we'll be looking at in particular is related to the burnt offering. So this time around, we're going to be just reading Leviticus chapter 6, verses 8 through 13. So we started in verse 8 and going through 13. Then the Lord spoke to Moshe, saying, command Aharon and his sons, saying, this is the law for the burnt offering. The burnt offering itself shall remain on the hearth of the altar all night until the morning, and on the fire. And the fire on the altar is to be kept burning on it. The priest is to put on his linen robe, and he shall put on undergarments next to his flesh. He shall take up the ashes to which the fire reduces the burnt offering on the altar and place them beside the altar. Then he shall take off his garments and put them on the other garments and carry the ashes outside the camp to a clean place. The fire on the altar shall be kept burning on it. It shall not go out. But the priest shall burn wood on it every morning, and he shall lay out the burnt offering on it, and offer up in smoke the fat portions of the peace offerings on it. The fire shall be kept burning continually on the altar. It is not to go out. So thus, you got what? A couple of witnesses there. To do what? Kick back and let the fire go out, right? No, you're supposed to be maintaining it. Maintaining the fire on the altar. So what is this? Is it supposed to be like a Texas A&M bonfire where you just have a gigantic pile of wood and you just keep throwing logs throwing log after log after log, just throwing them on until the fire reaches up into the heavens 24 hours a day, all the time. Is that what is meant in here? Well, pray without ceasing. So one of the things that, you know, we note there when we talk about offerings and prayer, it's kind of interesting you bring that up, because there are a couple of specific elements related to the tabernacle that are, you could say, are directly connected with prayer. One of which we see is the altar burnt incense right before the veil. So you talk about between the holy place and the most holy place where the Ark of the Covenant is, that's where you have the altar burnt incense. And you get the picture both in the Torah and also in especially the book of Revelation there about the altar with the prayers of the saints, the holy ones that will go up continually. But you could say also another interesting point you make about the altar, because it relates to the things that draw near. One of the things we talked about is with the korbanotes, the offerings, the things that draw near. Everyone who comes in the front door, one way into the tabernacle, in a sense, you are transformed with your korban as it comes in, and your korban continues in toward the presence of God. So, in a sense, very interesting they bring up about the altar, because that, in a sense, is yourself also going up before the Lord. Yes.
Yeah, as Paul says, as I die daily, and then I must crucify this flesh. Because, I mean, if I'm not having the fire and the altar keep going to do that, then I'm in trouble.
Yeah. If you don't have the fire going continually. Because one of the things that we saw in the first, the first passage that we looked at is that what started the fire? Did someone get out their matches, start the thing up, get out their lighter fluid, get the altar started originally? Is that how the first one went up? What started the fire? That's right. It said fire came out from before the Lord and started the first one. So then what were the priests? Remember, this nation of priests, what are they supposed to do? They're supposed to then keep it going from that point, keep that fire going. One of the things we see, and we'll go see again as we get into Numbers, in Numbers chapter 4, verse 13, we'll see specifically that when they get up to move, when they get up to move the tabernacle, or when the pillar of cloud gets up to move, what are they supposed to do? Just leave bury the coals, then go out and get some more lighter fluid to start it up again? No, it says they're supposed to pack up the coals to take with them. And yeah, there's traditions that go on as how they pack them up, and you can see that today if any of you are really into barbecuing about how you manage your coals. Very important, because you don't cook everything over the Texas A&M bonfire. That doesn't work that well. It may work for the burnt offering, but not for things to go on a long period of time, and especially if you're talking about managing your resources well. So one of the things that you also see, that if you're managing your resources well, you make sure that what you are going to do is going to go for the long term. And so thus, your coals and what you do with them, hugely important. So when you say, okay, great, that's fantastic little how-to guide for the priesthood. Fantastic. Why should I care? Because remember, this is a pattern showed after what was showed on the mountain for what was going on in heaven. So also a little bit of a lesson. A lesson being in how we manage our fire. We talked about before the altar being something about where we offer things up. And the Apostle Paul brings out in Romans chapter 12, what are our offerings?
Thanksgiving.
That's right. Sacrifice of your lips, your praise, also of what you do, the way you live. That's one of the things that the prophets hit hard. And some people misunderstand the prophets when they hit hard about the practices of later Israel and how they were handling stuff like the sacrifices and the things of the temple, is that there was a lot of lip movement, but not a lot of body movement toward doing the things of the Lord. Their lives were quite a bit different from what they were talking about, or hopefully they were passing along something related to the word. But when you see passages like, you know, discovering the book of the law and the back of the temple somewhere, and then people weeping after hearing it, it gives you an idea that, well, maybe not even the priests were communicating much of what the word really said to begin with. So one of those things that we could say with friendships, and especially with marriages, very close relationships, that everything is just not a Texas A&M bonfire. And if you go into relationships thinking that it's always going to be that way, that's either a recipe for burnout, or one thing you hear a lot is, well, the fire is going out. I guess, you know, the thrill is gone, all kinds of other phrases you might put to it. Well, okay, so it's died out, then we have a huge problem. Or is it fire management? Are we managing the fire that we have for the long term? That it will be something that burns hot, but just won't be huge flames that just consume everything around. A little bit of the difference there between your passion of the moment and commitment for the long term. You might think of coals being commitment and big flames being passion. So coals you can depend on for a long period of time. Flames, they go up and down based on how much fuel you throw into them. So one of the things that you can say is a good lesson from that, so when we think of being on fire for God, people might get distressed if your, quote, fire goes out, and then, oh, we have to keep stoking it with revival all the time. Well, are we managing ourselves to be always, you could say, white hot like coals, so that they're hot for long periods of time versus just, oh, you know, I get revived one day a week and then it just dies out, you know, and then I have to get out the lighter fluid again and throw it on and up comes the flames again and it gets exciting and then up it goes down again. Or are we like coals throughout the rest of the week? You could say that. So one of the things that we could say of a good passage that's related to this comes from Mark chapter 12, verse 28 through 34, and it relates to what we're talking about today, because the title of the section we're talking about is Tzav. And tzav is, you could say, command. You might have heard of mitzvah. It's related to the same word, you know, that which is commanded and, in a sense, done. So one of the topics that came to the Mashiach here, Mark chapter 12, starting in verse 28. One of the scribes came and heard them arguing, and recognizing that he had answered them well, asked him, "What commandment is the foremost of all?" And Yeshua answered, "The foremost is, 'Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your mind, and with all your strength.' The second is this, 'You shall love your neighbor as yourself.' There is no other commandment greater than these." The scribe said to him, "Right, teacher, you have truly stated that he is one and there is no one else besides him, and to love him with all the heart, with all the soul, with all the understanding, and with all the strength, and to love one's neighbor as himself is much more than all the burnt offerings and sacrifices." When Yeshua saw that he had answered intelligently, he said to him, "You are not far from the kingdom of God." So you see here is a few quotations, if you're paying attention. Hopefully, one of the things that your copy of the word should have is either highlighting where things are a quotation from the Hebrew scriptures, or got a good cross-reference in there to show you where things are at. And then in particular, the first two things that Yeshua is quoting is from Deuteronomy chapter 6. We call that the Shema. We saying that as we started things out here today. And the other part there is we'll be getting to later on in Leviticus in chapter 19, the what's often called the holiness code about loving your neighbor as yourself. But in this, what we see is his answer that the scribe gives him, that these are much more than all the burnt offerings and sacrifices. So, just like what we were talking about before, does that mean that all the burnt offerings and sacrifices were a distraction? Or were they supposed to magnify those two commandments? Love the Lord with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, to love your neighbor as yourself. These should be exemplified. We should be learning these things through all of the burnt offerings. And one of the things that we have talked about in previous occasions when we talk about the burnt offering is that it's called the olah offering, that which goes up, because that's what it's supposed to do. Everything's supposed to just go right up. That's the one where I guess you'd say maximum fire on it to burn everything up. So a good picture of that is all of us, that which was before consumed. So what better expression of love the Lord with all of your heart, with all of your soul, with all of your strength? The things that were holding you back from the all, that has to go up, be burned up. So that's where the main high points was looking to hit with the Parashat Tzav today. Now we continue on to the next part is one of the passages from Shabbat Zachor, and it's a brief passage that comes in from Deuteronomy chapter 25. So Deuteronomy chapter 25, verses 17 through 19. That's going to set the stage for our stage performance today, which we don't have a stage, but imagine that there's a stage here. So all the world's a stage, and we are merely players, performers and portrayers, each another's audience. But one of the interesting things that a lot of people have noted is the thing of, you know, hypocrites aren't anything new. We saw them at the time of the Gospels, and that's one thing that can detract from our witness. Our testimony, the testimony of the Lord we've been talking about here, the Ark of the Testimony, that testimony is the Lord is revealing himself, not wanting to hold anything back. So, with ourselves, are we one person one day, and then another person the other days? One of the things about the longer discussion about there in the garden and what was going on there, but one of the things is, and the Apostle Paul kind of hints at it in passing, is for us to be seen as we truly are, and to want to be seen, which is also kind of a little picture of Genesis chapter 3, but preview of coming attractions. Back to Deuteronomy 25. We're going to look at verses 17 through 19. Remember what Amalek did to you on the way when you came out of Mitzrayim, how he met you along the way and attacked among you all the stragglers at your rear when you were faint and weary, and he did not fear God. Therefore, it shall come about when the Lord your God has given you rest from all your surrounding enemies in the land which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance to possess. You shall blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. You must not forget. So you're like, what on earth was this big thing with Amalek? Yes.
Okay, so this is the revenge of the Lord. This is not the people's revenge. Is that right?
Well, who was supposed to carry it out?
The people were going to carry it out.
The people were supposed to carry that out.
Are we supposed to remember the hardships or things that others have done to us and blot them out?
Well, one of the things that the Torah is teaching us is to do as you are directed in the time when you're directed. And when you also are looking at one of the things that people will say against the Torah a lot is, well, if I see my neighbor out there doing something, mowing his lawn on Shabbat, should I just go over and kill him? Well, what does the Torah say about that? No. No. You don't do those sorts of things. And one of the lessons is you get later on and you look at the cities of refuge. That's a good example of, wow, vigilantism is not something where you're directed. Don't take it upon yourselves to do this or that or the other. And if you kind of look at the subtext of what was going on in the Gospels and the discussions there with among some of the zealots and such, that is a part of the subtext. Look at what the Lord is doing, and as we'll look at in our play of Purim today, the Lord may be giving you a time out in a different country under a harsh leader. And that might actually be the plan. And it may look like, well, you're just left off there by yourself, but no, that's actually a part of the plan. And a part of the plan may be for you to be that coal there, just burning white hot there in an area where it looks like, oh, the fire is going out. No, it's actually burning very strongly. And watch out, it's really, really, really hot. You don't want to grab it. And we'll see later on today, someone did try to grab it. And here we have with Amalek. Amalek tried to grab it at not going at where its strength was, but going at its weakness. So one of the things, you get this picture of what is the adversary pictured as? A roaring lion going around, always getting you at your best. When you are ready for him, you see him coming and wow, you're not ever going to fall for it. No. Gets you at your weakest. Aaron, 1 Corinthians chapter 10 says, hey, be careful if you think you're standing because, wow, that's when the sneak attack is going to come. It's going to come for your flanks. Come in the ways where you are weak. And if you know your weaknesses, you can maybe be ready for it when those attacks come. So know what your weaknesses are. Defend against your weaknesses. So, the next section we're going to be taking a look at is over in 1 Samuel chapter 15. So here we looked at about the command, wipe out the memory of Amalek. 1 Samuel chapter 15, we're going to be kind of just starting off here. And we'll start with verse 1. Then Samuel said to Saul, the Lord sent me to anoint you as king over his people, over Israel. Now therefore, listen to the words of the Lord. Thus says the Lord of hosts, I will punish Amalek for what he did to Israel, how he set himself against him on the way while he was coming out from Mitzrayim. Now go and strike Amalek and utterly destroy all that he has, and do not spare him, but put to death both man and woman, child and infant, ox and sheep, camel and donkey. Then Saul summoned the people and numbered them in Telaim, 200,000 foot soldiers and 10,000 men of Yehuda. Saul came to the city of Amalek and set an ambush in the valley. Saul said to the Kenites, go, depart, go down from among the Amalekites, that I do not destroy you with them. For you showed kindness to the sons of Israel when they came up from Mitzrayim. So the Kenites departed from among the Amalekites. So Saul defeated the Amalekites from Havilah as you go to Shur, which is east of Mitzrayim. He captured Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive and utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. But Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep, the oxen, the fatlings, the lambs, and all that was good, and were not willing to destroy them utterly. But everything despised and worthless, that they utterly destroyed. Then the word of the Lord came to Shmuel, saying, I regret that I made Shaul king for he has turned back from following me and has not carried out my commands. And Shmuel was distressed and cried out to the Lord all night. Shmuel rose early in the morning to meet Shaul, and it was told Shmuel, saying, Shaul came to Carmel, and behold, he set up a monument for himself, then turned and proceeded to go down to Gilgal. Shmuel came to Shaul, and Shaul said to him, Blessed are you of the Lord. I carried out the command of the Lord. Shmuel said, What then is the bleating of the sheep in my ears, and the lowing of the oxen which I hear? Shaul said, They have brought them from the Amalekites, for the people spared the best of the sheep and the oxen to sacrifice to the Lord your God, but the rest we utterly destroyed. Then Shmuel said to Shaul, Wait, and let me tell you what the Lord said to me last night. And he said to him, Speak. Shmuel said, Is it not true, though you were little in your own eyes, you were made the head of the tribes of Israel? And the Lord anointed you king over Israel. And the Lord sent you on a mission and said, Go and utterly destroy the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they are exterminated. Why then did you not obey the voice of the Lord, but rushed upon the spoil and did what was evil in the sight of the Lord? Then Shaul said to Shmuel, I did obey the voice of the Lord and went on a mission on which the Lord sent me, and I brought back Agag, the king of Amalek, and have utterly destroyed the Amalekites. But the people took some of the spoil, sheep and oxen, the choice of the things devoted to destruction, to sacrifice to the Lord your God at Gilgal. Shmuel said, Has the Lord as much delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed him than the fat of rams. For rebellion is as the sin of divination, and insubordination as iniquity and idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has also rejected you from being king. Then Shaul said to Shmuel, I have sinned. I have indeed transgressed in the command of the Lord and your words, because I feared the people and listened to their voice. Now, therefore, please pardon my sin and return with me, that I may worship the Lord. But Shmuel said to Shaul, I will not return with you, for you have rejected the word of the Lord, and the Lord has rejected you from being king over Israel. As Shmuel turned to go, Shaul seized the edge of his robe, and it tore. So Shmuel said to him, The Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you today and has given it to your neighbor who is better than you. And the glory of Israel will not lie nor change his mind, for he is not a man that he should change his mind. Then he said, I have sinned, but please honor me now before the elders of my people and before Israel and go back with me that I may worship the Lord your God. So Shmuel went back following Shaul, and Shaul worshiped the Lord. Then Shmuel said, Bring me Agag, the king of the Amalekites. And Agag came to him cheerfully. And Agag said, Surely the bitterness of death is past. But Shmuel said, As your sword has made women childless, so shall your mother be childless among women. And Shmuel hewed Agag to pieces before the Lord at Gilgal. Then Shmuel went to Ramah, but Shaul went up to his house at Gibeah of Shaul. Shmuel did not see Shaul again until the day of his death, for Shmuel grieved over Shaul, and the Lord regretted that he had made Shaul king over Israel. Wow. But one of the things you might hear some kind of subtle undertones here of another incident we read just somewhat recently about the golden calf. It's like, wow, people just did what they wanted. I mean, I'm just the ruler of the people. What am I going to do? Yeah, somebody else's problem. And you probably noted also in there, the Lord, your God, in that. So I think about later on in Shaul's history is where he's looking for the voice of the Lord. Well, was he even looking for it at this point? Interesting. And also you might notice something that the prophet said to him. He said, someone who's better than you is coming along. So now you can sort of see what was going on with Dawid when he finally was chosen and went to move forward. Yes.
David begged God for forgiveness, and Saul asked, you know, he begged for forgiveness. And so I thought to myself, what was the difference between when David asked God for forgiveness for what he did to Uriah, and Saul had done the same, you know, I guess.
What was Shaul doing in his great apology?
Making excuses. David, yes, took responsibility.
He said, Psalm 51 is a great example of taking, owning it, as you might say,
right,
today.
Yeah.
Owning your screw-up.
Yeah, I was still doing the compare and contrast of what it is.
Yes.
So when you are asking, God will forgive, but the humility of your heart has,
yes,
to do with. So somehow he knew that Saul's heart was not,
yeah, and
pure.
You might also notice what the prophet also said to him. He said, you know, has the Lord as much delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? So, thus, it gives you a little window into the tabernacle. It is about the heart. Always about love the Lord with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength. Yes.
I think,
with all,
you
your
know,
mind as well.
In verse 30, he says, that Saul says, I have sinned, yet honor me now, I pray.
Yes, glad you noted that one.
And also before the elders, because he wanted to look and appear to be honorable still before the people. So, you know, be careful that we don't want everybody to just say,
yeah,
oh, what a wonderful person you are. And that's the real reason behind your doing what you do.
All right. Well, now we are going to go into our section here on Esther. So this is not going to be a deep dive because we're going to be going through an abbreviated form of that in our play today, but just hitting some highlights on it and also answering the question we started from the outset. What is so important about keeping the 12th month where Purim is celebrated with the first month where Pesach is celebrated? So, a couple of things we're going to look through here. First off, just in a little bit, we just read that part about Shaul and also kind of the things that go down there. There's the command about Agag and the Amalekites to take them out, but Shaul did not go through with it. So, an interesting thing we have here is about what tribe was Shaul from? Yep, so Benjamin. And what tribe would Dawid come from? Yehuda. Interesting. So, Amalek, Benjamin, Yehuda. We're going to see them again when we get to Esther. So, an interesting little thing about Esther, and we talked about Shaul and how he was chosen. And then later, when the selection of Dawid was picked, about, oh, hey, should we go for the tallest, the oldest of the family? And then finally it goes down to, no, that's not the one that the Lord picked. The one that was, you could say, in a sense, forgotten. Forgotten to even be part of the family. That was the one that was picked. So when we look at Esther, an interesting thing we see there, that the king of Persia picked Hadassah for outward beauty, but the Lord was really picking her for inner beauty. And you see a couple of examples of that in from Proverbs 31 there, that charm is deceitful and beauty is vain, but a woman who fears the Lord, she shall be praised. And that is the beauty that doesn't dim through time. It doesn't dim through time. So thus, if you ever get any great advice about who to look for not only for a spouse, but also for a friend. This is great advice about looking for someone who fears the Lord. To look for someone who's got the quality of coals, not just big flame that will die out if you don't keep throwing wood on it, or, as they say today, getting work done. So, another passage from Esther itself, Aaron will be encountering this pivotal passage, Esther chapter 4, verses 13 through 14. And Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, "Do not imagine that you in the king's palace can escape any more than all of the Yehudim. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Yehudim from another place, and you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this." So, prepared from the beginning part of her life for what would be later. So that's a lesson for us. What is it that we have been prepared for in life? Or if life started out in a bad direction, what have you rebuilt your life around? Something that's more in the line of Texas A&M or Kohl's that will make it for the long journey. So, now on to this question of Purim and Pesach. So, one of the first passages we'll take a look at, just little snippets of them, and Esther 3, verse 7. In the first month, which is the month of Nisan, and we'll be seeing these things as we go through the book of Esther, these little notes of time. So you might have noted that when the word notes the time that things happen, that's significant. Should take notice. So the first month, the month of Nisan. So that first month, the first month of the year. So in Nisan, now called Abib, the first month, which is also where you select your lambs, and then Pesach comes, and then first fruits, and then matzot and unleavened bread, and then you start the great countdown to Shavuot or Pentecost. That starts all there in the first month. Well, something else was starting there in the first month. Haman, the descendant of Agag, of the Amalekites, was also, he was counting, casting lots, or Purim, to determine the date for this. And it says he kept casting them. And finally, he was looking for the day, and the day came down to the 12th month, the 13th day of the 12th month, also called Adar. So another highlight in this from Esther chapter 3, verse 2, 12, sorry. Then the king's scribes were summoned on the 13th day of the first month, and it was written just as Haman had commanded the king's satraps. So, going to codify this and send it all out there that this would be the determined day. And what is the 13th day of the first month? Now, some people might think of that as the cleanup day, you know, get the leaven out. Yeah, spring cleaning, get the leaven out, preparing. Well, that's started off a few days before that. So the 10th day of the first month is when you're picking the lamb. So kind of you're sort of in the middle of that, or near the end of it, really, the selection period for the lamb, because then the 14th day is when the lamb will be brought forward there, pretty much near the end of the 14th day. So that's kind of the interesting little time period that that's coinciding with. And also, you see that when you look at things, it's also day that Yeshua was calling for the go to prepare the Pesach for it. So, in the day that was being noted that, hey, this is when you're sending out basically the death sentence, that the countdown to destruction is starting, and it's kind of sad when you think about that, because that was sent out in the first month. And when was it going to be carried out? The 12th month. I mean, imagine that, a whole year of this like cleaver hanging over an entire population, you know, and it counts down day after day, day after day. Yeah, you're almost sick. You might think that they would, might have even had a countdown clock there in Susa, where they were just saying, you know, 11 months and you're all gone, 12 months. And continue on here. A little note here in Esther, chapter 4, verse 11. I had not been summoned to come to the king for these 30 days. So she's speaking to this in the first month, which means 30 days from like the middle of the first month. Where would that be? To the middle of the 12th month. Kind of Just a little kind of a note here. It just seems like thrown in. So this is like the middle of the 12th month. So, and she had not been summoned into the king's presence for that period of time. Almost in a sense, kind of like forgotten. Now, coming down here to Esther chapter 5, verse 1. Now it came about in the third day that Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner courts of the king's palace in front of the king's rooms. And this is, of course, after she had talked about having the fast for 3 days and three nights, that they were she and her maidens. And then she asked also her relatives and the rest of the people of Israel to also fast for this, because she was going to be going in. So if you think that that was something, the edict went out there on 13th day of the first month. So on the third day she went in. So what day was that? And we note that it was on the third day, not after the third day. So 13th, 14th, 15th going in. And that kind of coincides with what? The first day of unleavened bread. First day of unleavened bread. So Pesach. So you think this, you're talking to people in exile. So they would at least have some sort of memory of what what Pesach was all about, and thinking about, hey, this is the time period for it. And some of the, you know, like the Midrash Rabbah talks about that, yeah, Passover and Pesach was heavily on the minds of people at the time period, that this was something that was being missed. They were not there at the temple anymore, but the temple, you could say, it was in their heads, living through it. So, going on also into Esther chapter 5, verse 4. If it pleases the king, may the king and Haman come this day to the banquet that I prepared for him. So, wow. Then also, on the 15th day of the first month, going in, having the banquet. And you know, read through about how they're enjoying the feast, and then coming back again. Esther 5, verse 8. May the king and Haman come to the banquet I've prepared for him, and tomorrow I will do as the king says. So kind of moving forward then into the 16th day of the first month. So 16th day of the first month, by one tradition, that is where you are going to start the countdown towards Shavuot, towards Pentecost. So that's also in the minds of people going forward, that hey, this is something that's happening. The countdown, you're counting down to one thing. You got some other people who are counting down to something else, towards total destruction. But also at a time period where you're supposed to be celebrating the redemption, called the month of redemption, the redemption from the house of bondage. And where are you sitting? In bondage, in a foreign country, again, celebrating the salvation from another country, a foreign country, in bondage. So lastly, we kind of finish things out here. Esther chapter 6, verse 1. During the night, the king could not sleep, so he gave an order to bring the book of the records, the chronicles. They were read before the king. And this is where he gets the big discovery. Hey, you had one of the chief ministers from this exiled people in your midst who saved the life of the king. And he was overlooked. He was not honored. So, interesting on the day there where you were going to be, the plan was for Haman to erect upon the tree. It talks about gallows, but there in the Hebrew of the text, it talks about etz, which is a tree. So this is a pole, because either is a very large tree, and 50 cubits is pretty tall. That's what, about 70 feet or something like that? So either be a big tree or a pole is connected together. Anyway, the idea of the interesting thing of a tree, and you know, there's various traditions on why the tree was picked versus other ways of wiping them out, but the interesting picture of the tree, what was seen to be a curse for one, for Mordecai, ended up being a curse for Haman, for the one who is descendant of Amalek, the one who had come down as being the next generation to try to wipe the people out yet again. And one of the things you'd see in there is that this... Yes, of Agag of Amalek. So thus you could see the interesting picture that this beginning part of the 16th day, you see a switch from one to the other, from Mordecai to Haman. And lastly, we'll kind of leave with this passage here from Esther 6, verse 6, where it says, "So Haman came in, and the king said to him, 'What has he done to the man whom the king desires to honor?'" So what was to be done? And he thought, wow, hey, Haman was going to get honored. But that which was seeking honor was then destined for dishonor. And an interesting thing that we see here is that Yeshua came as the tabernacle made flesh and then is exalted above all. And you see in passages like in Isaiah 53, where came to his own and his own didn't recognize him. His own did not receive him. But just leaving with that last passage there from Hebrews chapter 2, verse 9. "But we do see him who has been made for a little while lower than the angels, namely Yeshua, because of the suffering death, crowned with glory and honor, so that by the grace of God he might taste death for everyone." So thus, you could say, the greater honor being given. So, that is a little bit of the backstory here, and why there is significance in a book that doesn't specifically have the name of God anywhere in it. But thus you see that the subtext of what the Lord was doing with all of the things he instituted with the pattern that was shown to Moshe on the mountain, which included Pesach and Bikurim first fruits and Shavuot, those things were continuing on, and that pattern is also flowing underneath the subtext of Esther. So, any last thoughts as we close out things here today? Yes?
I was just thinking how much that paralleled even Messiah's thing and the Egypt thing, because the Pharaoh is the one who announced the final plague, and here Haman announced what his death was going to be, and Esther was so brave, and she had to go before the king in order to spare the people. And what she said was, "If I die, I die.
I die."
And so she was a type of Messiah in there.
Yes. So that picture of the Mashiach, the one who's anointed to go and be the representative and also to put one's life on the line for the people, is a massive coincidence that just keeps showing up in the Word. It's just coincidence after coincidence after coincidence, which is what? Not true. It's called pattern after pattern after pattern after pattern. Kind of like the pattern shown on the mountain. So hopefully we... All God's appointed times. And will be, I guess you could say, a time that was appointed for one Hadassah to stand up and stand in for the people. So that concludes things today. We'll head off into our play here shortly. Thank you. Let's close with prayer. Father God, we thank you for giving us this pattern ahead of time and showing us what it is that you're doing, revealing to us that even when it looks like that you're not at work in the world and at work in our lives, that you will stoke the coals. Father, we just pray that you guide us in not letting those coals go out with inside of us. Father, that we can be your light in the world. Father, we thank you for these things in the name of your Son, Yeshua. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. Hallel.info.